I'd like to talk about alcoholism. And I would like to say that I think there are two very distorted attitudes in our society about this subject. The first is that it is funny. You know, there's the typical joke about the alcoholic brought into the police station who says to the policeman, what did you bring me in here for? And they said, for drinking. And he said, well, fine, let's get started. And the other false and distorted attitude about alcoholism is that it is a disgrace. It's a shame. And we say, don't they know what they're doing to themselves and to others? And it really isn't a disgrace. It's a disease. It's a sickness. And so I would like to address most of my remarks to the people, not who are alcoholic themselves, because you can't reason very well with an alcoholic while he's still drinking, he or she is still drinking, but to the families affected by alcoholism. In a remarkable pamphlet from which I have drawn much of my material by Joseph Kellerman, a pamphlet called A Merry-Go-Round Called Denial, the author, Joseph Kellerman, states that no one can become an alcoholic without the help of at least one other person. Alcoholism is a family disease, and as I hope is clear by the time I'm finished, I think that it is certain that rehabilitation, recovery from alcoholism, must be initiated, must be started by the family, not by the drinker, but by those who love the drinker. I would like you to consider the development of alcoholism as though we were watching a play or a drama on a stage. We see the alcoholic up there, and we see him taking some drinks. And he discovers the effects of alcohol. Oh, it feels good. It dissolves anxiety. It reduces his tension. You can see that. You watch him up there. He doesn't seem as lonely. It seems to remove his loneliness. And at least for the while that the alcohol is still working on him, paralyzing his central nervous system, he seems relaxed. His problems seem distant. And this is the beginning of what they call psychological dependence. It always precedes physical dependence or physical addiction. I remember a doctor who was an alcoholic telling me one time that when he was a little boy, his father, who was also a doctor, gave him some brandy when he had a bad cough. And he remembers still to this day how he felt as a child, how he felt almost as though a part of him which had been missing had been supplied when he was drinking. As we watch our play, we notice this look of contentment, this look of relaxation come over the face of the drinker. And gradually, alcohol becomes his best friend. It becomes the most important thing in his life. And now we are into physical dependence. It's interesting that physical dependence, the addiction of alcoholism, is a progressive disease. And it keeps progressing. Even if a drinker, if an alcoholic were to stop drinking for 10 years, the disease of alcoholism would still progress. We know that. That's been tested, that even after people give up drinking for a while, if they go back, the results are much more devastating than they were when the person stopped drinking. Because the disease progresses. The disease is relentless. Now, other members of the family of our drinker up on the stage, other friends, they get displaced. Alcohol becomes his best friend and constant companion. Communication is blocked and difficult. He doesn't want to hear about his drinking. He doesn't want to listen to any warnings of what is happening. He doesn't want to be accused. It is the merry-go-round called denial. two priest friends of mine, both of whom are recovering alcoholics and members of Alcoholics Anonymous, were talking to me about this, and I asked them, what is behind denial? Why does the alcoholic so firmly deny that he has a problem? Is it because it is a stigma, it's a disgrace, it's thought of as a stigma and disgrace by our society? And both of them said, no, it isn't. It's that if I admit I have a problem, then I've got to stop drinking. And you can't imagine yourself getting along without alcohol. Just as you couldn't imagine yourself getting along without your best friend. And so both of them said that the denial is based on the fear that if I admit a problem, then I've got to give it up, and I can't do that. When you watch an alcoholic drink, you notice that he drinks a little differently than the non-alcoholic. He drinks harder, faster. He tries to conceal the amounts if he can. In our play, as we watch our alcoholic, he would go off stage to have a few drinks. He tries to hide his drinking. At the same time, he protests, I don't drink any more than anyone else does. And by this time, by the time that physical addiction has set in, he's no longer drinking out of choice, but out of necessity. Now, he is sick. He is sick. When you say it's a moral disgrace, that implies that the free will was capable there of turning that around, and his free will has been overpowered by the physical addiction. It is no longer a moral problem. It is not a disgrace. It's a physical sickness. He's simply overpowered. Now, anyone can become an alcoholic. Anyone who drinks enough can become an alcoholic. They even train chimpanzees, you know, primates, to become alcoholics by ingesting, by having them ingest liquor. But there seems to be a genetic predisposition in some to cross that line more quickly than others. They call it the dose time addiction trigger. Some people have a faster trigger than others. A couple of Irish friends of mine who are in Alcoholics Anonymous tell me that they call it the Irish virus, that the Irish seem to have a quick trigger, a dose time addiction trigger. Once the disease has set in, it's incurable and it's progressive. It keeps progressing. It keeps getting worse and worse. And so there are stages of alcoholism. But as we continue to watch our alcoholic on the stage drinking, we notice that after a few drinks, he begins to feel good about himself. He feels like he's on top of things. There's a change in his attitude. And sometimes they call this the neurosis of omnipotence. He thinks he is right and everyone else is wrong. And eventually, as the disease progresses, it strips our poor alcoholic of all his independence. It tears off all his masks and leaves him a helpless, dependent, and immature child. Now comes on the stage of our drama another person. As we said, no one can become an alcoholic without the help of at least one other person. And this person is called the enabler, the person who enables the alcoholic to continue his drinking. No alcoholic can go on without at least one enabler. The enabler type is usually Mr. or Mrs. Clean. They're do-gooders. And they set up a rescue mission. They have a strong messianic complex. They condition the alcoholic to believe that there will always be a protector. There will always be someone who will come to his rescue, who will take care of him. Now, this may be hard to accept, but sometimes being a rescuer, being an enabler, is almost as compulsive as drinking is for the alcoholic. The enabler, in his or her own way, is just as sick as the alcoholic in some ways. It's a psychological compulsion as opposed to a physical compulsion. But the fact is that the enabler sets out to do a good thing, feels compelled to do it, and eventually becomes sick. Alcoholism is a family disease. It's interesting that when they analyzed brainwashing used in war since the Korean War, They said the secret of brainwashing a person, of fragmenting, breaking them down, making them sick, is to set him up with a one-to-one relationship with one of the captor soldiers. And the captor treats the prisoner unevenly. Some days he's very nice, and some days he's very angry, and suddenly, unpredictably, he just changes his mood. And the poor prisoner begins to think, somehow he's bringing that on. And that breaks him down. And he's sick. And then he's capable of being brainwashed. And the exact same thing happens in the family of an alcoholic. The alcoholic is unpredictable. Some days he can be very nice. Suddenly he turns very mean. His conduct is unpredictable. And the people around him begin to think, we must be bringing that on. And then they get sick. Then they get fragmented, just like the prisoner of war who is being brainwashed. And they begin to be riddled with guilt and anxiety. And that plays into the disease of alcoholism. It enables the alcoholic to go on drinking. There are others that can assist the enabler: the boss, the commanding officer, the business partner, the secretary, anyone who assumes the responsibilities of the drinker, of the alcoholic, takes over his work, covers for him, makes phone calls for him, makes excuses for him, saves his job, is contributing to that alcoholism. No one can become an alcoholic without at least one enabler. What they're doing is they're protecting the alcoholic from his crises, the crises that might have turned him around and directed him back to sobriety. They're saving him from those moments. Now, these enablers feel that they must not fail. They must always be there. They must protect the poor alcoholic from the effects of his drinking. So they clean up his messes, they teach his classes, they pad his cell, and they absorb all the painful consequences and the psychic pain of his drinking. And the big thing to face is they are not loving him. A Jesuit priest, a brother of mine, said, I was a drinker. For 20 years I was an alcoholic. And other people would take over my classes when I was too hungover to teach. And no one loved me enough to confront me. But finally he said, thank God there was someone who did. Someone who confronted me. Someone who loved me with a tough love and said, you're an alcoholic. You're destroying yourself, and I don't want a box seat at your destruction. I'm blowing the whistle. This is it. Thank God, he said, someone finally loved me and was willing to confront me. Being a rescuer, being an enabler, is not loving. When you love a person, you try to do what's best for them, and what's best for the alcoholic is that he have his crisis, he have his pain, and he allows it to turn him around. It will turn him around unless that pain is absorbed by the enabler, unless those crises are prevented by the enabler, unless the enabler keeps him from his crisis and his pain. The chances are very good that he will, at least in the early stages, turn around. As the alcoholic that we're watching up there on that stage becomes more and more dependent and addicted to alcohol, his denials to those around him that he has a problem have to become proportionately stronger, because as the evidence mounts, he has to mount a campaign of defense. So he denies that he is the source of the problem. He accuses the family members. He blames them. He insists that everyone else is crazy. He takes on the role of the accuser, and he brings up improbable things. He can even accuse his or her spouse of infidelity. The first area that is affected by alcoholism is the relationships in that person's life. The person begins to accuse others, and those relationships deteriorate. And this is one of the first signs that there really is an alcoholic problem. Some alcoholics try a different strategy. They maintain their denial of a problem behind a wall of silence. They simply refuse to discuss drinking or anything else about their behavior. And the merry-go-round continues. The drinking, the episodes, the confrontations, the words, 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 the promises and the relapses, and the act goes on and on and on. Will the alcoholic ever recover? I think it all depends on those around the alcoholic. The others who are involved in this drama of alcoholism must understand the true nature of this as an illness, and they have to be willing to rewrite the script. If they keep playing the same role in the play, they keep enabling, there's little hope of recovery. The merry-go-round will continue, and it'll go round and round and round as long as they are willing to ride on the merry-go-round with the alcoholic. Now, it's not true that the alcoholic can be helped if he wants help, but he can't be helped until he wants help. That's at least a half wrong, because the people around him have to help him face his need for help, to realize his need for help. And there can be no recovery as long as the others are willing to remove all the painful consequences of drinking. I remember one time working with a woman, married woman, who was an alcoholic, and she kept saying she didn't need help. She was maintaining her denial. And I said, if you ever want to go into treatment, I will arrange everything. I will take you there. And she said she didn't need that. One day, her husband got up and left a note on the kitchen table and said, I'm taking our child and I'm leaving. I've had it. When you are willing to undergo treatment for your alcoholism, I will come back. That day, she called me and said, take me to the treatment center. But as long as he kept absorbing all the pain and covering over all the crises and taking care of her responsibilities, she wasn't willing to stop. But the moment he left the note on the kitchen table, I'm gone. When you're willing to go into treatment, call me. On that day, she went into treatment. So that the others in the drama of alcoholism have to seek information and encouragement to reverse their roles. And sometimes this involves taking on some counseling themselves. And this counseling works best in groups. And the group that is most successful in giving this counseling, in helping this enabler or the family of the alcoholic to reverse their roles, is called Al-Anon. And for young people, for teenagers, it's called Al-Ateen. And so my strong advice, which I'm going to repeat later, is that if there's an alcoholic, a problem drinker in your family, or even if you suspect that there's a problem, go to Al-Anon. Go to the Al-Anon meetings. Go bring the children to the Al-Ateen meetings. It's really important, because all recovery has to be initiated by the people around the alcoholic. They must face the fact that they are perpetuating, they are aiding and abetting the illness of the alcoholic. Now remember that the classic enabler is usually a good person, someone who likes to help others. They even see themselves as born rescuers, do-gooders. They'd rather save a drowning man than teach him to swim. There's a lot of satisfaction in being an enabler. I think I tend to be that type myself. You feel good about being a help to other people, about acting virtuously, and it relieves your own anxieties. It reduces your fears and diminishes your own sense of guilt. Think of all the good I did. I covered for so-and-so. And they take satisfaction from being needed. They're saying to themselves, the alcoholic, he or she, can't make it without me. I'm really important. That person needs me. Many people in the professions, the clergy, doctors, lawyers, social workers, and so forth, can contribute to this enabling. Many of them are professional enablers who don't know that this is a sickness. One doctor said, and he's a doctor who works with alcoholics. He's a psychiatrist, and he's worked with some of the famous people who have admitted their chemical dependency. He said in a talk I heard him give, when you go through a medical school, you go through 4 years of medical school, and you have one 2-hour lecture on the number one disease of our country, namely alcoholism. 4 years of medical school and 1 2-hour lecture on alcoholism. Most doctors have no idea of the true nature of alcoholism. A lot of the clergy are that way. One Jewish friend of mine who's an alcoholic went to his rabbi and said, "I think I'm an alcoholic." And he laughs and says that the rabbi told him, "No, you're not. Jews do not have that problem." And it is true, by the way, that the alcoholism is less frequent among Jewish people. But some of the clergy and the doctors and the social workers go on contributing to this enabling. And the alcoholic, who has to develop some strategies, becomes very clever. Usually alcoholics are gifted people. And he knows how to play these people like a piano. He knows how to get sympathy from them. And people in the helping professions are usually the sympathetic types, people who want to do something good with their lives. And when they fall victim to the strategies of the alcoholic, the merry-go-round goes on and on and on, around and around and around. And sometimes if one person tries to step out of the enabling role, one person in the family tries to confront the alcoholic, others, along with the alcoholic, will very likely accuse that person of being insensitive, unsympathetic, even selfish. And then that person begins to feel guilty. And that's why you need an organization like Al-Anon or Alateen to give you instruction and to give you the courage not to be an enabler, to step off the merry-go-round, to ride no longer. But when a person in a family of an alcoholic does go to Al-Anon or Alateen, they have to be warned not to expect magic. Enablers, who are sometimes, by the way, called co-alcoholics, because an alcoholic has to be helped by the people around him. Sometimes these enablers need months and months of counseling in order to help them take on a new role. They have to change their own attitudes, and that isn't done overnight. And that's why membership in Al-Anon or Alateen is absolutely necessary. When people come into a counselor, they always say, "How do I change my husband? How do I change my wife? How do I change my kids?" And the answer of all good counselors is usually the same: change yourself. Change yourself, and they have to change. If you're a doormat and you feel I'm being walked over by everybody, well, cease to be a doormat. Cease to invite people to walk over you or to excuse them when they do walk over you. Stand up and say, "This is a person. I'm not a piece of putty." And they have to change. You can't walk over you if you're standing up. And the same thing is true of enabling and alcoholism. You have to simply change your role, and as I say, that's not easy, and may require months of working on those false attitudes. Now remember this, that an alcoholic, that alcoholic up there on the stage that we've been watching, he or she needs a supporting cast to continue playing his or her role. It can't go on unless there's a supporting cast. And that's why Al-Anon and Alateen become very important, to help the other players on that stage step out of their roles, refuse to be a supporting cast. I would like to read some notes from people in Al-Anon and Alateen. They publish a magazine called The Forum. It's a little booklet, actually. And I subscribe to that and read it religiously. This first letter is from a lady in Ohio, and it's entitled, "What Al-Anon Means to Me." "At Al-Anon meetings, I found that I am not unique, that there are many others who have problems similar to mine. I finally was able to comprehend that I have absolutely no power over the drug alcohol and accepted this fact without reservation while trying to detach myself with love from the suffering of my alcoholic husband. Al-Anon has helped me to accept a higher power, whom I call God, to surrender myself to do his will. And this has brought me personal growth as I strive to use the 12 steps in my life. Al-Anon taught me that I cannot change any other person. I learned that I am capable of changing my attitudes to bring about my own serenity. Only I can secure my happiness. It does not depend on others or their actions. Al-Anon has made me honest with myself and everyone around me. I admit it when I am wrong, and I express it to others. And so I am able to communicate my fears, my doubts, and questions without feeling ashamed or inadequate. For the first time, I have begun to like myself. I am getting rid of my negative attitudes toward myself that I have carried inside for such a long time. Reading Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon materials has given me knowledge about alcoholism, so that I no longer harbor the irrational feelings of guilt that I am personally responsible for my loved one's drinking problem. Al-Anon gives me hope. It has fostered a growing faith in myself and my abilities, and has brought about a whole new way of life for me, one which gives the inner peace for which I have searched but could never find before. That's from a lady whose husband is an alcoholic, and she wrote that to this magazine, The Forum. Now I would like to read a letter from a young girl who is a member of Alateen for the teenage children of a drinking parent. At age 15, I was living in a world that was turned upside down by the disease of alcoholism. Hardly a day would go by without arguments, tears, and a whole lot of tension. It was not a happy time for me. In addition to all the other problems of adolescence, alcoholism brought much pain into my life. Night after night, my father would stagger home from work, the smell of liquor thick on his breath. As he tried to greet us, his children, with his unintelligible mumbling, we shrank back in fear and disgust. And I, after years of adoring my father, began to feel my world falling apart. Here was the man whom I had put on a pedestal throughout my childhood years. How could he do that? How could he act like such an imbecile and hurt us so much? I looked for reasons. I looked to blame someone. And my mother became the obvious target. She was too nasty to him, I thought. She's driving him to drink. We're all too loud, too noisy, not doing well enough in school, not doing anything good at home. No wonder poor man drinks. Eventually, I laid the blame, perhaps hardest of all, on myself. My own way of reacting to my father's behavior was to withdraw and bury myself in books. However, my brothers and sisters reacted in many different ways, some in anger and even violence. With the situation getting out of hand, my mother began threatening my father with separation. She loved him dearly when he was sober, as I'm sure we all did, but could not cope with his drunkenness. Yet, she never followed through with her threats. And then one day, someone suggested Al-Anon. My mother went to a few meetings and knew that Al-Anon was the place for her family. We were encouraged to go to Alateen meetings, and at the age of 15, a new world opened up before me. The shy, frightened, and hurt person inside me began to change. Well, I've come a long way since then, and I cannot thank Alateen and Al-Anon enough. With the help and support of the groups and through reading the literature, I have become a different person. I've learned to change the things I can and to let go of those things I couldn't change. No longer shy or frightened, I am able to reach out now to others in need. In this program, I've had wonderful experiences with some very special people whom I love. They helped me to grow and become the person I am today. I hope I am passing on my experiences to those I come in contact with. There are many hurdles yet to jump in my life, and of course I have my shortcomings to work on too. Still, I know that with the serenity, the courage, the wisdom, the strength, and the love that this program and the people involved with it have brought into my life, I know I will make it. That was from a young girl living in Bronx, New York. For a person is a whole new attitude, a whole new role, to step out of the role of enabler in the drama of alcoholism. And it means that they have to change their actions and reactions. There can be no more removing the consequences of alcohol for the alcoholic. No more absorbing the guilt. No more willingness to be manipulated. No more messianic behavior trying to set up a rescue mission. They have to be able to say, no, I won't be imprisoned in this miserable world. And you have to be prepared, and this is why I think the continued support of Al-Anon and L-Ateen is necessary. You have to be prepared that when you try to change your role, the alcoholic will soon become the accuser. He will disapprove and even threaten with violence any kind of manipulation. He will do everything he can to subvert the effort. I remember one lady telling me that when she told her husband, I'm not going to live with this anymore, in a very calm voice, and she had the children recite their determination that they're no longer going to support this or live with it. If necessary, they will leave him. He said he was going outside for a few moments. And he later said, after he had achieved sobriety, he later said what he went out there and started thinking about was either killing himself or killing all of them. It just seemed that alcohol was such an essential part of his life. He was so sick that those terrible thoughts entered his mind. And with the grace of God, he came back in and said, I'm ready to go to AA, the Alcoholics Anonymous. It's really important to understand that others must initiate recovery. Very often, the enablers, the other person in the alcoholic drama, think that the alcoholic is not going to make it without their help. And the kind of help they're offering, the support of the alcoholic by absorbing his crises, just permits him to go on drinking. So I strongly suggest that if you see signs or even develop suspicions, go see a professional. Go to Al-Anon, go to L-Ateen. And if Al-Anon isn't available in your neighborhood, look it up in the phone book, then go to open AA meetings. And don't let a sense of shame keep you away, because you're not dealing with a disgrace. It's a disease, not a disgrace. It's a sickness, not a shame. Once I used to say Mass down on near Skid Row in Chicago here, and the Legion of Mary, the Legionnaires, would go out and bring in these poor men, most of whom were narcotized by wine, for Mass. And they would come over to talk to me, and I would hold them up. And one day a man tottered over to me, and his face was covered with a stubble of white beard. And he said to me, as he looked painfully into my eyes, "Ego quoque sacerdos," which is Latin for "I am also a priest." And indeed he was a sick priest. Not a shameful priest, a sick priest. Not suffering from a disgrace, but from a disease. So, you have to have that mentality. If you think of it as a sickness rather than a shame, you won't be held back from going to the meetings, from going to get help. This is a sickness. Just as there must be organizations for people who are relatives of those who are terminally ill, these are organizations for people who are also incurably ill with the sickness of alcoholism. Now, there are alcoholic information centers, there are mental health centers, but Al-Anon and Al-Ateen, in my judgment, are the best. And be prepared now, when you go, to have your own defenses broken down. Remember that the enabler is also playing a denial game. Most enablers say, I don't need help, it isn't my problem, he's the drinker, she's the drinker. But you do have a problem. You do have a problem, because no alcoholic can continue without co-alcoholics, without other people in the supporting cast willing to help him or her play the role. So the important thing, I think, is that you regard alcoholism as a sickness, not a shame, as a disease, not a disgrace. Another doctor friend of mine, who is also a recovering alcoholic, says that if you think it is a disease and not a disgrace, early recognition is possible. But on the other hand, if you think it's a disgrace, you won't be open to recognize the early symptoms. And there are early symptoms, and the sooner an alcoholic is confronted, as soon as the enablers step out of the merry-go-round, step off the merry-go-round, the sooner that's done, the easier it is to reverse the trend, because the addiction isn't as progressed. Now, we live in a drug culture, a culture of analgesics, sedatives, tranquilizers, stimulants. Kind of a mechanistic view of man. You pop a pill, just like you would put more gasoline or oil into a machine. The motto seems to be, fly now, pay later. And alcohol is a drug. It's a powerful mind drug. The most common drug scene in our current society, our contemporary society, is the cocktail party. Sometimes we older people wave our hands about young people and drugs. But we overlook the fact, and it is a fact, that drinking alcohol is taking drugs. And that relaxed feeling that we claim we drink to get is really a partial paralysis of the central nervous system as a result of this drug. There are many reasons why alcohol has lost its identity as a drug. We just don't mentally classify it as a drug in our common thinking, because it's been with us from the beginning of recorded history. Noah was said to be drunk on the ark. And also, alcohol has been used symbolically. In the Mass, we consecrate the bread and the wine. So it's used religiously, too. And in some countries, alcohol is a common dinner beverage. It's thought of as a food, but it's not a food. It has lost its identity. It's a drug. And it even offends some people to say that. It's a drug. But it's more than just a drug. It is also a toxin. It is a poison. You know, sometimes people say that when they hand you a bottle and a glass and they say, pour your own poison. That's exactly what we're pouring. It is a poison. We speak of a man who, or a woman who is drunk, we speak of them as intoxicated. And what it really means is they're poisoned. Because the body doesn't digest alcohol as it does food. The liver has to metabolize it. And that's why people after prolonged drinking develop cirrhosis of the liver. The poor liver has tried to filter out of the system this poison. It is a poison. It is a drug. And yet, we go on saying, oh, it's not a drug when it really is. It's not a poison when it really is. And we don't look at the destruction that is caused in society by drinking. 40% of all the people in our jails are there because of an alcohol-related crime. Industry in the United States loses $10 billion a year in lost time due to hangovers and drug reactions. 30,000 people are killed every year on our highways as the result of drinking drivers. And 2.5 million people on those same highways are crippled, are maimed, due to drinking drivers. My doctor friend, who says that you get 1 2-hour lecture in 4 years of medical school about the number one disease, says that it's the principal cause of divorce, it's the principal cause of crime, it's the principal cause of death, even though it is not listed as such. They say the man died of cirrhosis of the liver, the man died of hypertension, the man died of a stroke. But in most cases, alcohol has played a role. In our country, it's estimated that 100 million people drink regularly, and 1 out of 10 of these will become an alcoholic. And they also say that there are 20 alcoholics for every one person addicted to another drug. Alcohol is the most widely used drug among young people. And because it is a toxin, because the body has to labor against the effects of alcohol, if you drink 3 times a week, you never have normal sleep and you never have a normal nervous system, because your system continues to try to repair itself from the effects of the alcohol. Now, I suppose I'm beginning to sound like a teetotaler who is preaching against the evils of demon rum. And I think that some people can drink occasionally, and they can enhance an otherwise enjoyable situation with a drink. And I see no objection to that. But I think we have to face the facts. And the facts are that it's very dangerous. Alcohol, frankly, scares me. The effects that it could have and the imprisonment that it could lock me into. When you're looking at someone or you're looking at yourself and asking, what are the first signs of danger that the person is slipping into alcoholism? The experts say that it's when you have to use alcohol as a tranquilizer or a help in order to do something. I need a drink in order to relax, in order to sleep. If you're a salesman, I need a drink to go out and make a sale. To express my feelings, to get my feelings out of me, I've got to have a drink. I remember another friend of mine who admits to being an incipient alcoholic, an alcoholic in the primary stage, was telling me a story one night, story of being robbed. And he started the story out, and then he said, no, I can't go on. I can't tell you the rest of this story without a drink in my hand. And when I asked him about that, he said, I think I'm addicted. If you need alcohol to do something, to express your feelings, to keep up a conversation, to tell a story, the warning signs are already present. Sometimes we ask when we see these first signs starting to appear, well, why don't they stop? Why don't they see what's happening? Why don't they see what it's doing to them? And this is set out of an attitude of moral righteousness, but it also implies considerable ignorance. If they're alcoholic, they're not free. They're not free anymore. And they have to go for help, because their will is no longer free. You can't reason with an alcoholic while they're still drinking. Drug dependency is a profound and overwhelming addiction. It results in an irresistible urge and need, and these are beyond the strength of the human will. It's a sickness, a physical sickness. There's no question of willpower. The will has been overwhelmed. The will is rendered helpless by the addiction. It's not no longer a moral problem. It's an addiction. It's beyond the power of the alcoholic. And this need, this urge to drink, achieves primacy in the alcoholic. It becomes the most important of all the human needs and urges. It even precedes the needs of human hunger. Alcoholics frequently have a drink rather than a meal. Alcohol becomes a best friend, a constant obsession, and a crutch without which there's no walking. And the urge to drink doesn't even need stimulation anymore. It's always there. And once hooked, once addicted, the alcoholic is incurable. He's always going to be an alcoholic. He may achieve sobriety through abstinence. Abstinence is his only real choice, and perpetual abstinence. And with continued abstinence, this urge to drink diminishes. It never really disappears, apparently. And the addiction, the sickness, is progressive. It goes on even during the years of sobriety. Sometimes we tend to diagnose alcoholism in its early stages by how often a person drinks or how much a person drinks, and these are not reliable. It's much more important to ask, how does he use drugs? Why? Does he use drugs, the drug of alcohol, in order to do something? And the most important thing, remember, is to diagnose early. The sooner alcoholism is diagnosed, the better the chance of recovery. You know, other diseases or illnesses aren't dependent on diagnosis only in the later or advanced stages. We all know that, why we take cancer checkups and so forth. Catch it in its early stages. The sooner you get it, the better your chances of survival. And it's the same thing with alcoholism. Some of the early recognition signs that the experts tell us about are these. These are early recognition signs. The alcohol has a kind of preoccupation with alcohol. He wants to go to a restaurant where drinks are served. He worries about that. Will we be able to get a drink? He's preoccupied with it. He or she, I should keep saying. And then there becomes an increased tolerance. He used to have one drink before meals. Now he has two. He needs more of it. And he seems to tolerate more of it. And when he drinks, he doesn't sip a drink. He gulps drinks. And sometimes you find him drinking alone. His use of alcohol is to tranquilize himself, a little nightcap so I can sleep better, or to alleviate physical symptoms. I'm tense, a pickup, or a calmer. This is why he or she uses the alcohol. And sometimes, if they're willing to admit this, they have blackouts. They don't remember what happened last night, where they parked the car. They don't remember some of the incidents. When the families in alcoholic rehabilitation centers begin to confront the alcoholic, and I have sat in on some of these confrontations with... With the facts of conduct, you can see denial written all over the face of the alcoholic. I didn't do that because of the blackouts. They don't remember doing that. An alcoholic in the early stages is also recognized by protecting his supply. Always has to keep some on hand. Just as he's preoccupied with this, he also keeps some on hand. And the last of these early recognition symptoms is a non-premeditated use of alcohol. I guess the question should be put this way. Is your drinking different from what you would like it to be? You know, I didn't intend to drink so much. And some people laughingly say, I didn't overdrink, I was overserved. But it wasn't what you intended when you went there. You didn't intend to have that many drinks or to fall into that condition. This is an early recognition symptom. And people say that if these symptoms, or even most of them, are regularly, consistently present, it's a certain sign that that person is in the early stages of alcoholism. And remember now, recovery is going to depend mostly, the initiation of recovery certainly, will depend on the people around that person. The usual steps to recovery are these, that something painful happens, a tragic situation, traumatic situation. He loses his job. She falls into some kind of public disgrace. There are financial debts piling up as a consequence of the drinking. Now, if at this point, when the pain starts to mount, the family and friends refuse to be enablers, the situation is now looking good. If they allow the situation to be painful and to deflate the neurosis of omnipotence, the egotism of the drinker. And then he says, I need help. But he has to come to that point. He has to choose humility as a way of life. And then I think the usual way of recovery is that he seeks and finds help in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, which has the best record of helping people recover. His own will has been overpowered by this addiction, and he goes to the group and he absorbs strength from the other wills, the other support members of the support group around him in Alcoholics Anonymous. He really needs that the people around him, the family, the friends, should be instructed by Al-Anon and Al-Ateen not to support him, not to be manipulated by him to keep drinking. Their support is to love him with a tough love. You know, love can be tough or love can be tender. And you have to ask yourself, what's best for this person? And in the case of the alcoholic, tough love is the order of the day. A blue steel, not blue velvet. Because when the alcoholic can no longer manipulate those around him, he usually will seek help. One man said, no matter what strings I pulled, my wife, who was going to Al-Anon, didn't respond. Nothing happened. My wife regained her freedom from my alcoholism, and because of this, I eventually found sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. So the primary target then in rehabilitation from alcoholism is the family. I remember one time a professional friend of mine, a man in a profession, was drinking too much, and I asked his wife about going to Al-Anon, having him go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and she said, "Oh, no, no, it would hurt his practice. It might even ruin his reputation." Mercedes McCambridge says that the pride of the family has killed more alcoholics than any other factor. And that's why it's really important that we think of this and talk about alcoholism as a sickness, not a shame, as a disease, not a disgrace. Al-Anon and Al-Ateen are not for the recovery of the alcoholic, but for the recovery of the family, where all help has to begin. Because if there's one alcoholic in the family, you can be pretty sure of this, after a while, everyone is sick. At least they're emotionally sick as a result of the one sickness. Now, these are some facts that the experts offer us for our consideration. The average family notices the problem of alcoholism only after it has been advanced for 7 years. And then the average family waits 2 more years before doing anything. Now, notice that the experts also tell us that early diagnosis, the early turning for help, the better chances of recovery. Most alcoholics are locked into denial, and it is up to the family to break that lock. Recovery begins with the family. It requires a lot of courage, a lot of knowledge, but it has to begin there. And no one is ever responsible for the alcoholism of another. No wife has ever made her husband an alcoholic, or no husband has ever made his wife an alcoholic. No more than you could make them a diabetic. You can aid and abet addiction, alcoholism. You can refuse to initiate recovery by tough love, but you can't cause the illness. You can't make a person an alcoholic. And to try to stop alcoholism without learning the facts and being willing to change yourself will only make matters worse. Screaming, crying, threatening, "If you loved me, you would stop drinking," is just as dumb as saying, "If you loved me, you wouldn't have diabetes." These theatrics, this refusing to talk, only make matters worse. Now, it's also true, the experts tell us, that the two main strategies of the alcoholic are to get the family mad at him, make them lose their tempers, and then he can use that to rationalize and justify his drinking. There's a statement in classical literature, "The gods make angry those whom they wish to destroy." And that's one of the primary strategies of the alcoholic, to get his family angry at him. Then he can say, "With a family like this, I need my drink." Or get the family worried and anxious, so that they will cover for him. They'll cover his bad checks. They'll make a phone call to say he's sick when he's really drunk, so he doesn't get into trouble. Because he knows if he can really get them worried, then he can go on drinking. They will cover. They'll take over his responsibilities. So please, I urge you, go to Al-Anon, go to Al-Ateen. Home remedies do not work. And in Al-Anon and Al-Ateen, we are instructed and enabled how not to enable the drinker, how not to destroy ourselves, how to become loving people. Al-Anon and Al-Ateen have the best record of helping people in this regard, because the person is helped to see through the problems, to see them for what they are. But it's also a spiritual program. It's not religious in the sense that it's affiliated with any one religion or assumes any one religious doctrine. But it's a spiritual program in that it turns over to the power of God the problem. God helps those who help themselves, and we have to do certain things, but we know that God has to cause the flower to bloom after we've watered it. It's interesting that in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, they're also used in Al-Anon, one step, the first one, mentions alcohol, and the other steps, the other 11, mention either directly or indirectly God or the higher power, God of my understanding. I remember one time, because of my interest in alcoholism, which arose from the fact that most of the people I were counseling were affected by this problem. I went to the Alcoholics Anonymous convention a couple of years ago at the Superdome in New Orleans. And I remember seeing 35,000 people there. And they would seem so beautiful to me. I remember thinking to myself, I don't think I've ever seen Christianity practiced so beautifully. Because these people had come into these programs to Al-Anon, Alateen, Alcoholics Anonymous, had really surrendered to this higher power, had really matured as a result of its fellowship and the 12 steps, living out the 12 steps. I thought they were really beautiful. I think this is what God had in mind. As one alcoholic said, Alcoholics Anonymous didn't open the gates of heaven to let me in. They opened for me the gates of hell to let me out. Alcoholics Anonymous gives to people a choice when they think they have no choice. And it gives to the alcoholic the kind of love which he feels he couldn't possibly deserve. Alcoholics Anonymous and Alateen, Al-Anon are the answers. Because the problem of recovery, the initiation of recovery, must begin with the family. And these are the instruments that we have available now for help. I'd like to close with the famous serenity prayer of these groups of Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, Alateen. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Thank you for listening. God bless you, and please remember me as loving you.